KZSU Stamford, 90.1 FM. I'm Mark Milano. This is the Henry George Program, show all about land, policy, and politics. Today the program, very special guest, Stephen Hoskins. You may know him online as Georgia Steve. And we're here to talk about meta-discourse. We're picking apart the many flavors of anti-Yimbys, anti-Georgists, and kind of talking about what makes them tick, what kind of political approaches are appropriate as a result, and much, much, much more. But without further ado, yeah, let's just jump into it. So, Stephen, thank you so much for being here today.
Absolute pleasure to join you, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so this is something that viewing your activity on Twitter, now X, if nothing else, there's been a weird progression of, I feel that you've been around for a while, clearly curious of trying to pick the brains of how other people who disagree with you view the housing picture, all sorts of things. And I think before we get into it, you know, I think you've been picking apart people who are kind of anti-YIMBY, also anti-Georgist, and that's kind of the same folks, kind of different folks. But I guess before we go into the kind of the weeds, how would you view the kind of overlap between the YIMBYs, the Georgists, and the antis of different flavors?
Yeah, excellent question. I would agree with you that that has been my journey. I would say I essentially started 5 to 10 years ago as, you know, self-identifying Georgist and self-identifying YIMBY, and have been sort of fascinated to discover the various flavors of those two things who agree and disagree with each other, and then the camps of people from outside of those two categories who, you know, virulently or otherwise disagree with either or both of Georgism and YIMBYism. So it's just kind of this endless thing that I'm interested in. And so to answer your question, you know, I see there's a bunch of categories of Georgists that we can step through. But I think the kind of most unifying principle at the moment in terms of how that label gets used is somebody who supports a land value tax. There are much deeper, you know, ideological roots and different flavors of that. But that's kind of my unifying description for now. And then for YIMBY, I think the kind of unifying principle there is a belief that we should relax the land use regulations and other kind of onerous taxes and things that hinder the development of, you know, denser and multifamily housing in urban areas. I think that's kind of it's a directional thing for YIMBY, I think.
A question to clarify, too. What's your origin story? Like, some people, like, went from Georgism into YIMBYism and vice versa, and some people have, you know, weirder paths. What activated you, I guess, in both categories?
I can't remember the order. I graduated as an economist and was working here in Auckland, New Zealand, essentially as an urban economist, and essentially, the context at that time was that the housing market was going crazy. You know, my generation was quickly discovering that we weren't going to be able to buy homes, you know, anywhere near like the age that our parents were. And, you know, this is kind of for middle and upper middle class people. And so a sort of this confluence of professional interest and personal interest made me just fixated on, you know, what is the cause of this problem? And, you know, I did a lot of work with the upzoning in Auckland. And so, you know, there was a lot of thinking about the role of land use regulations, and that kind of took me to YIMBY. But around the same time, I think I was also discovering Georgist ideas and thinking about the fact that sort of a lot of standard models of supply and demand in housing didn't do a very good job of differentiating between the land market and the market for houses on top of it. And the fact that land is really, really unique in terms of, you know, not being able to be freely supplied, you know, additional quantities of land in any given location are essentially fixed. So yeah, it kind of was through those both of those channels and that's kind of only built off of each other for, you know, the decade since.
Yeah, I remember back in the lead up to 2008, I was definitely following all the kind of chatter about, oh, real estate is currently overpriced. There's just a bubble. But there wasn't really much of an explanatory structure of what is a real estate bubble, and also, like, certainly nothing about how it actually corresponds geographically, or like, what should the price of a house be or something. And I guess it's like, well, what does it cost to build a new house? What does it cost to build a new house where? And I feel like, you know, kind of getting that last part kind of flipped a light on. But I guess when you're like in urban economics, and like as far as land versus, you know, kind of the more abstracted real estate, was how well was that covered as you were kind of working through that?
So it's interesting. There's kind of two different time periods. So I completed my undergrad around the time I think it was 2009. So, you know, right in the heart of the GFC. And a lot of what was being taught then was, you know, that it was a macroeconomic explanation and the kind of the Stiglitz kind of explanation for the GFC, which was really, you know, about the idea that this was a bubble that popped. And that bubble was due to kind of changes in, you know, the liquidity of availability of capital, and very much a sort of standard macro kind of story. Not much of a fixation on the role of land use regulations, or even really of land as, you know, being a great asset to do speculation on. Not really any of that at the time. And then by the time I came back into my master's, which was just a couple of years ago, in the kind of urban economics canon, I think the narrative had really kind of resettled back on land use regulations as the cause of this. And that, yeah, that it was about the kind of spatial displacement of people. You know, you couldn't build housing in the places it was needed, so it all had to go, you know, somewhere else. And that that formed this kind of this bubble of activity that then popped and set off the chain of events that followed. Yeah,
I remember in the mid teens, it was kind of an interesting point in most places. Like, oh, the bubble popped, and like looking at prices now, it's like, oh wait, it has now reached that level again. Which certainly it resists that narrative of there was something that weird happened, something went away. I mean, at the very you can say certainly that macro investment patterns caused a shock to the system that was not very well handled or prepared for, but it didn't really deal with the structural underpinnings of what goes on in real estate. And even if there is a lot true about that model of kind of surplus, kind of pointless investment or aimless investment, yeah, I think it is. It does make sense. People had to eventually get back to the nuts and bolts of housing, just kind of how this is created. Yeah.
And I kind of think that, like, in mainstream econ, there's not really, I don't think it's really kind of settled science about the role that macro factors and land use regulation factors and the kind of underlying role of land played in all of that. I don't think it's kind of a settled question at the moment.
It's very complicated dynamics. When you talk about macro, yeah. It's very hard. Like, how do you sum up the entire economy? Like, it's like it really resists easy classification. And then it goes to, I mean, this is just a sideline. It seems that there is certainly a cultural disparity in New Zealand versus Australia in responses to housing. Maybe this is the discourse more than actual, but it seems like New Zealand has a lot of practical reforms that seem to be producing more housing, and it seems to be kind of a movement that has a lot of housing reformers behind it, whereas it feels in Australia, there's a lot of people tisking and saying, oh, wait, we can't simply do more housing. Mm. And a lot of people are also doing things like pointing to, oh, it's not housing, it's the interest rates, which is referring more to housing prices for sale than anything involving renting. But is this overstated when you see stuff on like Twitter discourse, or is that a real division?
No, it's definitely a real division. I mean, as a Kiwi, I'm going to say that the Australians are basically just 10 years behind us in terms of figuring out these issues. So New Zealand, yeah, I mean, 2013 through 16 was when we did the Auckland upzoning, and there have been a couple of other ones in other major cities since. At that time, we kind of had a very big YIMBY debate and won a bunch of YIMBY policies, but it wasn't really called that so much at the time. And it was, I don't know, there was kind of a little bit more of a cross-party belief in the need for more housing from both our centre-left and centre-right parties. They only really disagreed on whether the housing should be, building up or out is kind of the terminology here. Should we do more sprawl or should we do more density? And because of that kind of general agreement that we needed more housing, and that we were, you know, we were going to keep having immigration. We liked immigration, you know, broadly. That meant we needed more housing. There was kind of a bit more of a general thrust for, you know, policies to allow more housing, and we kind of did a bit more sprawl in it and quite a lot more density. So that all kind of went through maybe before a lot of this kind of online, you know, YIMBY NIMBY stuff really spiced up. The Australians are behind us. They have similar, you know, they're kind of now really forming into organized YIMBYism in a massive hurry in the last few years. It's sprung out of nowhere and it's going bonkers. They're going to start getting policy wins. But I think their narratives have been kind of curtailed a lot more by, like you say, sort of discussion of interest rates, a lot more of a kind of reflexive anti-immigration stance as being the solution to the housing problem. And maybe even a slightly different kind of strain of Georgists that are over there who actually tend to lean towards, we don't need to do upzoning. What we need to do is tax land. Yeah, which have kind of played their role over there.
Yeah, it seems like there's certainly a few of those folks around, and they seem to find a very big audience because there's people who are just anti-upzoning who are willing to give a platform to anyone who says it. But actually, one thing that's kind of interesting to me is you're saying that it was a cross-party kind of agreement on upzoning, mm-hmm. and you said that mm-hmm. there wasn't really anti-immigration in New Zealand, even in the more right-wing tendencies?
It has a really interesting curve. So around about the time I'm describing, 2013 through 16, anti-immigration sentiment was more common on the left than the right, the centre-left in particular. And it was because of housing problems. You know, it was quite common in the Labour Party, our centre-left party, for it to kind of be all this immigration is just bidding up house prices and enriching homeowners, property owners, and sometimes, you know, not helping the wages of natives, of Kiwi-born people. So that was where anti-immigration sentiment was more likely to be found. And then kind of on the kind of the far right end as well, and a little bit in the kind of populist mushy center. So I think because of that, we had the center right support for more housing. You know, we got to build. We like our developers. More housing is good. And then so when the kind of center left party came around and was look, we want more density. We want more efficient cities. We want, you know, apartments and public transit. Then we kind of had a general kind of support for it across the sort of middle of the spectrum, so to say.
Was the center right to right, were they kind of still in that free trade, enlightened, pragmatic center right that used to dominate before, I guess, Trump, you know, brought populism to the overall right wing discourse?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right. And they have kind of they're still in the throes of like trying to stave off those instincts, and are still generally fairly kind of, you know, yeah, pro-business, anti-regulation, free trade, you know, immigration's good kind of a center right.
Yeah, it's interesting to see, like, in America, certainly Trump nuked the party, so there is no that pragmatic right wing doesn't exist anymore. But I'm kind of curious, from nation to nation, it seems like there can be a very different how have they responded.
That stuff is kind of, it's sprouting its head, and it's in our kind of populist party called New Zealand First, and it's a little bit in our sort of further right party called ACT. But in terms of the National Party, our center right one, they're kind of fighting over whether they're going to be the property of homeowners or the property of kind of property developers, I guess. And so they there was this cross-party, two national policy statements that sort of said you have to do medium density and you have to do even higher density around transit. Both of the center parties supported it. And then National have kind of gradually backed off it a little bit because I think they realized that it's not so good for property values, which is one of their major constituents. But yeah, anyway.
So a more in general, so stepping back from the antipodes and talking about the just overall dynamics, I mean, I think migration as far as housing and YIMBYism and everything is like really at the key of it. And I guess this is kind of my personal look at like how this is going on. I guess I'm kind of curious of how you agree or disagree. That, I mean, I think the U.S. populist right just became anti-immigrant for a lot of reasons. Cultural, you know, it's a little bit to do with a classic like labor. You might even say rent-seeking, don't bring in cheap labor. Policies has moved to the right wing. And like, okay, that's settled. But now, there has been kind of, I would say, a kind of nihilism, a futility that's set in among the center left, among a lot of places, which is the fact we have done so clearly a bad job with urban affordability that anti-migration for urban issues has become fairly pronounced of just our cities cannot handle more people. Our only way to create more affordability is to stop people from moving to our city. I think there's a lot of different tendencies you can dive into, and which has made it's basically been like an overall anti-immigrant across the spectrum, as it were. I feel like I personally am a bit of a weirdo insofar as I, in the abstract way, have just been like, I find freedom of movement to be a kind of very foundational belief, and it's kind of what drew me to both, you know, Yimbyism and Georgism and so on. But as far as kind of the urban futility narrative, is that something that you would agree with, or do you think there's, you know, other things at play?
Yeah, I would very much agree with you that this belief that, you know, people should be able to move around the planet in pursuit of, you know, what they see as their best opportunities and the best life for them, and that we should remove, you know, arbitrary obstacles to them being able to do that, is a very core value for both Georgism and Yimbyism. I think it's a major value that we both share. I think probably it's not all Georgists that feel that way. Probably most Yimbys do. And so I think that's part of what's kind of helping, you know, knit these two movements together. And I do also agree with you that it's a major strain of both, you know, anti-Georgism and anti-Yimbyism that we see. Sometimes we see it at the local city level, which is, you know, other people who don't live in our city right now don't have a right to be here. We don't really have to care about them. We don't have to worry about accommodating more housing for them. We have to think about the people who are here right now, you know, the city government should only worry about their well-being. And I think that is used for both anti-Georgist and anti-Yimby arguments, but it also gets mirrored then at the national level as well in kind of anti-immigration arguments. And I think you were hinting at this, these things can pop up from both the right and the left, and they can come from both left-wing and right-wing instincts if you don't kind of have that underlying belief that we have to worry about the well-being of everybody and that everybody sort of should have some ability to move around the planet in pursuit of opportunity. Yeah.
So a question, or meta question, I think this is always a question that comes up. What is the left? Like, what do you define as the left? What does the left mean? Because I feel like this can definitely kind of, this can definitely color a lot of discussions. Personally, like, just to go offhand, I will never punch left. I will never say, oh, the left is doing this, insofar as I identify as leftist, which means I do the most traditional leftist thing, which is to say I'm the only leftist, everyone else is a fake leftist, and I do infighting among the left, which is a classic tradition. But I guess, do you identify people more to the left of you? How do you identify that? What is this? Because I feel maybe in the 20th century, at least there was a general agreement of, oh, the left is the second world Soviet, or, you know, Sino-Soviet bloc. But now, what is the left in 2024?
Well, that's a defining question of the time. I mean, yeah, I agree that the origin of these terms, I think through the 20th century, yeah, was a lot cleaner, you know, around the left being, you know, I think anti-capitalist is pretty important, being primarily concerned with the well-being of labor, or of kind of labor's share of resources in the economy. Yeah, I think those are kind of defining features of the traditional left. And then the right kind of broadly being defined as more, you know, pro-market, pro-private ownership of capital, anti-government, perhaps. But yeah, it's definitely, it's getting a lot squishier. I think there are a lot of areas where the far left and the far right have, you know, kind of starting to agree with each other again. And for my kind of position with, you know, you say that you identify as left and the only true leftist. Yeah, I understand that that instinct, and I can certainly agree with you that I think a lot of what you advocate for is, or what Georgists advocate for, is achieving the goals of the left, quote unquote, better than a lot of self-identified leftists can. But I tend to take a little bit more of a, you know, I identify as a liberal, certainly a left liberal, but a liberal at the core, and have been really disillusioned by to discover that there are so many people on the self-identifying left who I think I share a lot of values with, but who are just like fundamentally toxic towards, you know, two movements, UMBs and Georgists, that I think would achieve a lot of left-wing goals really, really well. And so I have kind of shifted into being pretty comfortable with punching left when I think it's at toxic elements.
I'm fine punching at them. I guess I'm not fine calling them the
you
left.
You just don't define them as left. Yeah.
I mean, I think you were saying like, oh, the right, you know, is almost definitionally more pro-market. The left is more definitionally anti-capitalism. You can kind of talk. We had an argument a couple weeks ago about that online or something, about what is anti-capitalism per se. I feel like I'm pretty comfortable calling myself an anti-capitalist because I have a very, I feel, narrow definition of what that means in a way that I feel comfortable with. But I suppose it kind of means, like, for example, market socialism, is that coherent? A lot of people are in a kind of are in their own silo where they have no response saying, oh, that's obviously kind of an oxymoron, that's stupid, and they start like blowing raspberries, and like that's the end of the conversation, which is like, okay, I mean, which I guess to me this is, I feel, is identifying tendencies, one of the big tendencies, call it left or right or something, I mean, offhand, my definition of left is just basically egalitarian, anti-oppression, anti-hierarchy. But one self-identified tendency, or kind of one tendency that's coherent, is, I would say, anti-market, anti-quantification, which is just the fact they hate anything that there is perhaps a number put on anything. It's like they hate labor markets, not because labor is, you know, exploited in a, you know, in itself, or insofar as they feel it's downstream from the fact when you put a price on labor, exploitation is inherent or inevitable. I think usually inherent. But I think this goes down to like how do our cities operate? And there is an idea of like, if cities were a lot more kind of, you know, fluid and things were like less, you know, charged with price and trading and certainly commerce, things could be fairer, but you can never make quantification and egalitarian ends meet. And I disagree. I think sharing and quantification can agree. It doesn't have to be comprehensive. I feel like there can be a world in which there's spaces that are quantified, some places that aren't quantified. But I don't know. Is this? Do you find that to be kind of a division that you see?
Yes. I mean, I think that instinct is a major component of the kind of category of what I call kind of leftist anti-YIMBYs and leftist anti-Georgists as well. Yeah, so look, you know, one of the kind of key themes that I want to keep coming back to in this discussion is that I think actually Georgists and YIMBYs are united in a lot of ways by a shared set of enemies. So it's not just the values, it's also that we have kind of opponents who are, you know, broadly allied with each other. And this instinct that you're describing, I term them, quote unquote, the vibes are off socialists, which is that their reflexive opposition to both Georgism and YIMBYism is really what you're talking about, that they are policies or tools that use market forces, allow for quantification, they're technocratic, and they reflexively don't like those things. And that, I think, is a big part of their kind of their distaste for what we advocate for. So, yeah, the fact that, you know, we think that allowing for more housing to be built and that market forces can respond to that and improve outcomes doesn't sit right with them, because it kind of still involves prices and rents and those being used to set incentives and allocate, you know, housing to people and so on. And likewise for Georgism, you know, before you can capture the land value, you have to value it. Then charge that to the person who's there, and then redistribute that, and you're kind of doing it within the existing system of prices and market allocation of goods and resources, which again they don't like. And in fact, instead of those things, they prefer, you know, public ownership of land and housing, you know, public allocation of those things, rent control to kind of, you know, kneecap market setting of rents. And so on and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, it feels a bit awkward to be asking you. It's like, oh, well, what would these other people's stances be? And I will reiterate, I would love to have a conversation or argument with people who really believe these things and they want to talk about it. But it's weird that no one really will defend it that much. I think you're talking about some toxic forces. A lot more sniping and kind of just, you know, it's. I really regret that Tom Lord out of Berkeley died a couple years ago. And so far, he was like one of the only coherent theorists of this stuff. You know, no one else really goes to the mat on this. But
yeah, I would say that is true for a lot of them. And I have a long block list now of people who I have just found kind of uninteresting to talk to because they're more interested in the snipes and the dunks than. In kind of actually finding, you know, our points of disagreement and figuring out what they are. I will say that I think there are some really, really good people in that space who are genuinely willing to engage in those kinds of things and in that kind of discussion. And it's, you know, I think it's people like, you know, Tony Damiano, Chris Frenier, Yona Freemark, who, you know, are willing to like put down kind of their discomfort with, you know, at least with YIMBY ideas, you know, into a paper or discuss it with somebody. And I know that he's really disliked by people in this space, but Cameron Murray, I think, he's done a lot of work to try to kind of actually really espouse and defend, you know, why he thinks that YIMBY isn't going to help. So yeah, those people, I think, while I don't agree with, you know, all of their positions, I do think they get credit for, you know, trying to do the hard work and have a coherent theory that they can defend.
Cam Murray, friend of the show. No, I mean, going back to quantification, I feel there's two different things here. One is kind of a distaste. You know, the vibes are off. One is a, you know, distaste for the outcomes of how this world operates, either kind of in any snapshot, just like it's inherently dystopian to see price tags, or it will degrade. And I think I can at least see that argument of, oh, market socialism sounds great. Oh, you could share using prices, but it will always degrade into the haves and the have-nots. And like, I feel like that's probably the most sophisticated taste. The other, I guess, you know, other branch of that is perhaps the mostly purely political branch, which is the vibes are off because it's technocratic as a political approach. It's experts, it's middle class people, it's a relatively privileged, making their privileged views shown, as opposed to a grassroots, bottom up, you might say tenant led, but a movement that is really kind of class warfare, as it were. You know, some people, I mean, I think there's kind of a question of what is the history of and present of Georgists and class warfare. You know, what is the state of YIMBYs and class warfare? I think that's even muddier. But you know, I think some people feel that kind of a bottom up grassroots has to be the approach. And honestly, I guess my response to that is I agree in principle, but I think a major problem is that when you are a downtrodden underclass, you know, lumpen proletariat or whatnot, usually you don't have a whole lot of time for theorizing or anything else. And I don't know. But there can be a fetishization, if nothing else, the idea that the least well-off have the most wisdom. And I feel like a lot of people can be really exploited, but also be kind of stupid about stuff. Like, I don't think there's a, you know, any sort of contradiction at all in that. But I don't know. I mean, do you see stuff as like kind of like, how do you feel the political valence of a whole lot of, you know, approaches to if you're doing it the right way, or the wrong way?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a huge component of the vibes are off socialists, kind of distaste for YIMBYs and Georgists. It's both of what you describe. It's that, it's not coming from that, you know, grassroots bottom up, you know, tenant focused, origin, or working class, you know, labor kind of origin, and that it is coming from this kind of technocratic, you know, middle class, you know, approach that uses the existing kind of market and capitalist system to try and improve outcomes. I've sort of really don't enjoy any of these kind of debates, because then it becomes entirely about the structure of, you know, your movement, and who's funding you, and you know, what the aesthetic of your of what you're advocating for is. I personally am much more motivated by just, what are the outcomes of this thing? Do those outcomes improve the world? If so, we should agree that that's something we should push for and work together, even if we disagree about other stuff, or even if the vibes are off. So that kind of, I think that's actually been the source of a lot of my, you know, enduring frustration with people who I think I share a lot of values with on the, you know, center left to further left, because I think that Georgism and Yimbyism can do really great things for the working class and for workers and for tenants in terms of outcomes. But we get a lot of pushback because the vibes are off.
That's it. I mean, that's it sounds like a kind of full-throated rejection of metapolitics. I'm much more, I guess I have more of an appetite for metapolitics. And I guess certainly, yeah. I think in personal evolution, I think I've become increasingly comfortable with a materialist, you know, system. Insofar, is ideology downstream of materialism? I would say probably more than a lot of people would let on. I wouldn't say completely. I think there is a lot of room for kind of pure idealism. But, you know, the idea that ideology is shaped by incentives, yeah, that's certainly true. And what's interesting is that's usually used as kind of an anti-YIMBY or whatever, you know, statement. But the one place in most of these this discussion that cut against the grain is kind of elephant in the room of home ownership. The idea, a lot of people believe that material, you know, incentives matter a lot, except for personal real estate in a home that people own, if it's an owner-occupied. In that case, there is no there is no ideology to speak of. You know, you can throw that out. And, I mean, I think this goes to the anti-YIMS. This also goes to, I think, the history of Georgism. I think that if there's one critique of Georgism I make personally, Georgism felt that we can be idealistic and pure, and then also be pragmatically pro-homeownership, and, you know, there won't be any kind of problem. Whereas I think that a lot of the homeownership ideology had, I think, derailed, and I think personally kind of subverted a lot of the kind of Georgist juice, as it were, on an individual and certainly on kind of a population-based level. But I don't know. I mean, so I guess that's a way of saying home ownership. How do you, like, what is your view of how this is being treated in the discourse these days?
Yeah, I agree with you about the, you know, I don't think Georgists should be pro home ownership. I probably would go even further and say that I don't know that YIMBYs should be pro home ownership, because I think that the root cause of the kind of huge obstacle that both Georgists and YIMBYs have to push against right now is the kind of mid to late 20th century fixation on the home ownership society. That it is a social good if we can get, you know, a majority of voters to be homeowners, and that will, you know, automatically produce good citizens who are interested in, you know, improving their local community, and that will, you know, therefore improve the nation as a whole, and so on. I mean, I think that materially it has given a majority of voters very strong interest in, and it's financial, but it's also kind of, you know, idealist and lifestyle interest in blocking new housing, blocking affordable types of housing, opposing sort of subsidies for tenants in a lot of cases, or poor people, and certainly for opposing land value taxes, which kind of cut right to the core of that home ownership society. And I think that's a huge block that is an obstacle for both of our movements and for the people that we were describing before, the kind of tenant activism left.
Yeah, and I feel, I mean, you could accuse me personally, I think, of being accelerationist, and I think I would fess up and say, into a degree, I am. Insofar as, like, homeownership, a big, this is one of the kind of, I feel like, the left and right valence, it merges. Blackstone, BlackRock, buying up single-family homes and renting them out. You know, this gets a lot of people upset across the spectrum for different reasons, and I feel like it can be everything from, like, the right-wing, you know, valence is, this is going to turn everyone to bug men. We need, you know, strong individuals who hold the land. It's both the fact that, like, you know, land ownership is an inherent good, and I think it will belong to the strong as long as we don't allow Wall Street to get in. They're the only people who are stronger than our kind of gritty upper middle class. But then on the left, it's the idea that, one, it's bad. And I honestly kind of agree in the most immediate sense. I think it is bad that, you know, Wall Street is speculating on single family homes. It's going to take a lot of value if they actually get their hands in the pot. But I guess I feel that it is, if you are going to create a political coalition to share the land more equitably, they certainly make better villains, to say Blackstone and BlackRock, as opposed to, you know, mom and pop, you know, homeowners all across this area. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you might be calling me naive or whatever to say that I'm comfortable with it because I think it's going to lead to better politics. And I don't think I'm, like, just speaking in fantasy land as far as this even goes to, like, what is a political structure and let more people rent and what does the politics look like? Look at a place like Berlin in Germany. You know, almost everyone is a renter, and there's extremely radical politics for egalitarian ends. And I may not agree with every bit of the kind of ideology going on among, you know, kind of the solutions being baked up, but I would like to see a lot more Berlin, a lot less, you know, Palo Alto. I don't know.
Yeah, mine is, I don't know if it's accelerationist or not. I tend to not like accelerationism, you know, when it's foregoing things that can make the world better in the meantime. But, and so I'm not sure I agree with the kind of Blackstone, BlackRock make a better villain, partly because I think that sometimes leads to sort of fixation on policies that don't actually help that much, like just kind of banning those companies from buying property in certain places. My angle on it is much more of the latter of what you said, which is that, yeah, I think a society that's going to be good for tenants is one where you have a majority of people who are tenants, simply just from a, you know, political economy perspective. And I sort of underlying that, I guess, is that I don't really differentiate between the rent seeking or the private accrual of land rents that homeowners do rather than what Blackstone, BlackRock do. All of it's bad to me. I would like to abolish all of it with a land value tax. Maybe the sort of third prong here is that there's a question of whether sort of who you think is the core villain in you know, policies around housing and tax and inequality. Where I think a lot of people have this instinctive preference to blame the evil corporation that's doing shadowy, you know, lobbying and, you know, buying off politicians and so on. Whereas it's been my experience, and I believe this is the case, that in terms of urban housing policy and property tax policy, it's the home voter that's the core obstacle. They have a majority of votes. They show up like hell when there's, you know, any discussion of affordable housing or upzoning in their neighborhoods. They certainly, you know, hate the idea of taxes being shifted onto them or onto their land. And that, I think, is a more difficult obstacle for Georgia's TMBs and tenant activists than are the corporations that we were describing.
Yeah, the argument they would make, the people who are, I think, comfortable making an alliance with the homeowners, would be essentially going back to the use value, you know, kind of argument. Mm-hmm. That it's like, oh, the villains are people who look at spreadsheets, look at ways the number can go up. Who can I rub out? Who can I squeeze to make that number go up? Homeowners, they aren't motivated by optimization. And honestly, I agree. Homeowners are satisficers. They are not optimizers. But they also, like, they essentially believe, and this kind of goes back to politics as well, like, these folks who oppose the Yimbys, a lot of them kind of make up their own kind of villains of the Yimbys, insofar as, like, they're privileged upper middle class people who are fine punching down. They're fine punching down at marginal tenants. They're fine punching down the homeless. I don't, honestly, offhand, I don't think that's true for the wide majority of folks. I think there's basic empathy and also just kind of shared interests. I think there actually is a lot of, I think, care for the worst off in society among the Yims. But they believe the homeowners, because it's like, oh yeah, I would never go out of my way to harm the vulnerable. I would also say go to a privileged suburb and hear them talk about homeless people in city council. It's like, you would say it's like their property values being optimized or whatever. I'd say, like, it's social control. It's like a right wing tendency. There's a weird kind of pattern that people are comfortable ignoring that or something, or at least squinting and saying it's not true. And I think this has to, you talk about, you know, like, who is the villain? Developers, people moving in. It's like, if you read urban geography papers, you know, from left-wing theorists of the 20th century, there's this general narrative. There was once an egalitarian wonderland of our cities, and then, you know, Wall Street encroached, financialization encroached, and found ways we can profit instead of kind of just vibing. And I don't know, like, I find that to be a weird narrative, because it seems to indicate that only a change can be negative. Stagnation or kind of a very slow moving stranglehold around people's necks can never be bad, but it certainly seems to elevate a continuity of built environment as being the only thing that matters. And I think for a lot of people, you would call them like the left NIMBYs or whatever, certainly it seems that continuity of built environment is the number one issue they care about. I mean, you can call me off base, but that's at least a pattern I see.
Yeah, that's my reading as well. I think the homelessness example is a good place to kind of demonstrate this, because so you have the kind of right wing tends to be kind of homeowner, you know, NIMBY kind of, the thing they latch onto with homelessness is, oh, they're drug addicts, they're mentally ill, they're criminals. You know, that's the kind of personal, it's, you're blaming the individual. That's how they became homeless. That's their problem. It's nothing to do with me blocking housing or, you know, refusing to be taxed and in favor of redistribution. That's the right wing kind of blame the individual angle. The left wing kind of version of this, or sort of from those kind of vibes of our socialists, is as you're describing. It's they observe that at the individual level, homelessness follows eviction or the loss of housing. And their conclusion from that is that, you know, we need to stop people from being evicted, stop people from being displaced, stop gentrification, which they then tie to rent going up, and that also pushes people out into the street. So if we can stop the market forces, stop the, you know, the new constructions and the, you know, evictions or displacement that they require before they can break ground, we can lock everybody where they are currently, which is inside a house. That will, you know, prevent people becoming homeless. And then, well, we can grab some of the vacant rooms that exist, you know, throughout the country and put the homeless into those. And now there'll be no more homelessness. That's their kind of their story for the homelessness problem. And so my kind of pushback on the homelessness question from this Georgist Yimby middle ground, maybe, is it's not about the individual. It's about the systems that, you know, produce homelessness. The systems that do that are a place becoming very desirable, not enough housing being built in response, rents going up, people at the bottom end not being able to afford that and being displaced onto the street. And so to solve it, we need more housing and we need to be, you know, redistributing land rents so that people at the bottom can afford the base level of housing.
Yeah, I think there's kind of a synthesis. I see that, because I think you can talk about the stuff I fully just reject. And there's stuff that I think actually has, you know, I think real truth to it that I've actually come to, you know, embrace. And I think one of the more true things about homelessness, a pattern I've seen and kind of a truism, is it, you know, what makes people homeless is usually two things. It's on an individual basis, a shock takes people from being in a position in which they are stable to instability, and then general forces of unaffordability will keep them homeless. You know, if you're homeless for a day or two, but if you can get back on your feet, that's you could say almost fine, as it were. I mean, it can still be extremely disorienting and, you know, kind of people shouldn't be shaking around any more than they have to be. But certainly it's the shock and the unaffordability. And I honestly want to see more being done for both, which is to keep shocks to people's stability to a minimum and then also make affordability to a maximum. And I think some people go to one end or the other. There are some folks, I think, you know, on the YIMBY side who say, we don't need tenant protections. I mean, I would call these kind of the right neo-lib, you know, YIMBYs as it were. We don't need tenant protection or anything. Just if everything's affordable, just let her rip, you know, just no, we don't need just cause eviction protection. Just anything goes. Mm-hmm. I think that's silly. I think that's wrong. And there's people who feel we don't even really need affordability. As long as you live in the same place your entire life, you know, stability is the only thing that matters, which to me is you can point out flaws for why that is completely broken. Talk about family formation, talk about a couple that breaks up, all sorts of things, you know, aside from just general migration patterns. But I mean, I think the key is, when I say earlier, disruption should be kept to a minimum. If a city is to change and grow, what is that minimum? It's not zero. Like, if you build a building, there will be disruptions. And I guess to me, it's kind of a question of how do you make a minimum, which is not pushing people around any more than they absolutely have to, but sometimes people have to move. How do you have systems in which, for example, if a place gets rebuilt, people get moved around in a way which cares for them? Could there be actually kind of better social programs for relocation that don't work like mid-century urban renewal programs, but actually, you know, keep them well situated? I always point to like college campuses. You know, that's a place where people get relocated a lot, but there is actual care for people, you know, among when it's handled better. Whereas, you know, cities, a lot of times it's like, yeah, knock it down. Here's your eviction. Good luck, buddy. And I think that is bad. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The way I sometimes characterize this is to kind of picture a spectrum, a continuum, where, you know, on the far left, you have a, you know, hyper focus on security of tenure, of people staying where they are and being able to stay there as long as they want to, because that's their community. This requires you to kind of protect them from the land rent, or, you know, have them not be exposed to the, you know, the true social cost of them occupying that location on an ongoing basis. And it also comes with an anti, you know, a kind of an opposition to market allocation of land, of location, and of housing. That's one end. And then at the other end of the spectrum is a kind of hyper focus on spatial, what I call spatial efficiency. In economics, this is the idea that you allocate, you know, every piece of housing, every piece of location based on, you know, everybody's willingness to pay. And this requires, this kind of comes with exposing everybody to the full land rent at all times. And, you know, using market to allocate housing and land as the person put themselves on that continuum, because, you know, people who love home ownership often tend to do so for reasons towards the left wing of that spectrum, even though they might kind of think of themselves as a, you know, typically a very pro-market person. And yeah, so those, and likewise, those kind of protect the tenants, keep people in place, have anti-eviction, you know, mechanisms. A lot of those are coming from this instinct of tenure security for the poor and disadvantaged as being their like first and foremost priority. And I can see why. I would just kind of say, as someone who's fairly far down the kind of right end of that spectrum, it is, cities really require that kind of dynamism of people being able to move in and change jobs and move house when they, you know, when the kids leave home or they have a child or they get a new job. You know, it is good when people are, when we're not allocating, you know, locations just based on like who was there first, but some kind of mechanism of who, you know, values them more. And so I, to the extent that I want to kind of mitigate displacement and evictions and those kind of harms, I kind of would prefer to do them in, you know, targeted ways. I think that, you know, using a UBI to just put more resources in the hands of poor people can help them weather those kind of displacements, and even kind of, you know, show that they really value being in that house, you know, because they're willing to pay for it with the UBI. And then I kind of, something I'm interested in that I haven't really gone very far down the line of is wondering about the role of some kind of a subsidy program for people who have been sort of displaced or evicted, where, you know, we don't just completely protect you from it, but when that happens, you get a, you know, a bundle of support to help you kind of weather the tide, find a new place, and yeah, and so on. And then, sorry, and just one last point there is that I also think that kind of part of why the more right end of YIMBY, they can seem really callous in this regard because they might oppose those kinds of tenant protections that you were describing. Part of the reason I think they do that is that they believe that in an environment where there is a very, very, you know, high supply of housing going on all the time, yeah, you might be more likely to get, you might get displaced more often, but there's a, you know, a low rent place just around the corner. So you're being displaced from your house, but not from your neighborhood. Whereas in the current kind of, you know, constrained supply situation, there's a lot more of, well, we're not protecting tenants enough. We're not building housing. So when you get displaced to a different city. Yeah. Anyway, that was a ramble, but there you go.
Now, I wonder the synthesis, because I mean, I think that's there's something to that, but I think people can really, at the very least, like, you know, kind of underrate just moving sucks. Like the frictions of moving, it's not zero. In fact, like, even if you have a pretty small place, moving sucks, you know, it's not fun. Yep. But now you talked about earlier about like more support targeted for people experiencing displacement. Like, I mean, it sounds like an analogy to like unemployment insurance. It's the idea that you're not going to have the same job your entire life, but when you are off of that track, you are helped. And I, like, right now, we don't really have much of anything. There's some cities will put on moving assistance. It's usually kind of not much of anything. And when unaffordability is so bad, it's usually like it's a consolation prize for having to move in a couple months or anything. But even in a place where things are affordable, I think kind of helping those frictions with that analogy to unemployment insurance, I think it would be pretty good.
Yeah, and just to add from the perspective of urban economics, you know, one of our core assumptions in most of our models is that people can costlessly relocate.
Exactly.
And indeed that they're aware of every possible location that they could live in and the benefits it would provide them, which is obviously not true in the real world. And so I think there's probably also unexplored territory in terms of that kind of a relocation assistance or, you know, some kind of a support package if you get, you know, evicted or rent hike displaced, might actually end up improving, you know, spatial efficiency, getting, you know, improving our outcomes in terms of, you know, shorter commutes or houses that suit our situation, while also helping people at their bottom end who are more likely to be exposed to those kinds of displacements.
It's a, that would fit in well with a general kind of, at least in my mind, with the dynamics of social housing. Because if you have social housing plus a buffer, that does mean that you do have in your public programs, if you run it correctly, resources that you can get people like, oh, yes, we have, you know, kind of these areas where you can move into with this kind of contingencies and so on. Like having that capacity should mean really good things for being able to handle, you know, certainly shocks to your populace as far as that goes. But I guess that points back to, I mean, you can talk about kind of the approach to social housing, public housing, either as a part of it, as a cure-all, as whatever. But I would say one place that always sticks my mind is kind of a dystopia that points to certain flaws in people's approach is to me Stockholm, you know, which is Stockholm in a lot of ways is kind of the weirdly perverse utopia of use value, which is, instead of having kind of rent quantified in a way which, you know, you put your cash in the barrel head, you enter or whatever, it is very hard to get market rate rent tenure in Stockholm. You know, it is weirdly enough much easier to get, you know, kind of an owner occupancy to buy a condo or, you know, just a investment unit. That's fine. But for, you know, market rate rents, that is not handled well. They have social housing, they quote unquote have social housing, but it's to the degree that queues are on the orders of years and years. Yeah. It doesn't help most people. It doesn't actually get people where they want to be very well. But for a lot of people, I think that is a set of trade-offs they're comfortable with. They are fine saying, oh, I'm fine, one, looking the other way at owner occupancy, And two, I'm fine with people not getting social housing for years. Because perhaps this is uncharitable of me. I think a lot of people who are, I feel, social housing purists or panaceists, you know, people who believe it, you know, should replace all market rate housing, also seem to not really care about getting the numbers right so it works. It seems like the details of efficiency don't seem to be a high, goal in their scheme. But you can kind of, you know, comment on that, or kind of, you know, introduce, you know, the way that people address social housing in general.
So my read on the reason for that lack of quantification is that I think they tend to have a sort of a feeling that there is a an endless well of public revenue available if we tax the rich, and that you can get enough money from that to fund whatever social housing you need. I think that is the kind of unexamined territory. It's frustrating because they often aren't that excited about the idea of funding it with land tax, which I actually think would do a really good job of collecting local land rents and then devoting them to social housing to help people that are harmed by high local land rents. But anyway, aside from that kind of personal slight, I guess I'll say that I kind of am warmly supportive of social housing as a massive improvement on the status quo. It is a great way that we can, through, you know, the use of government, add housing in locations where it's desperately needed. And because it often entails, or public housing at least, entails public ownership of the land underneath it, it also serves to kind of bring some of those land rents into the public purse. I don't see public and social housing as the like panacea solution for the reasons that you describe, which is that, you know, whenever you're in a situation of providing, you know, subsidized below cost or below market price, you know, housing in a high value location, you are definitionally going to have, you know, an excess demand of people who want to move into it. And so it's very hard to do that. You know, if you were providing, you know, at cost social housing in Manhattan to anybody who wanted it, you would, you know, have a constant, you know, list of people wanting to move there, because that's great. Who doesn't want a, you know, super cheap apartment in, you know, the greatest city in the world? So, I think it's very hard to do it without ending up with very long wait lists or having to implement some kind of newcomer policy that says, you know, you only get this if you've lived here for a couple of years already, or it's only for people who are born, you know, who are citizens or something like that. So this is kind of why I don't see it as the be all end all. I do support it as an improvement on the status quo. And I certainly don't want to fall into the habit of what anti-YIMBYs do, which is to say that they treat that as a panacea, but actually it's bad. I'm completely fine with doing public housing, you know, in increased amounts from what we have now. I just don't see it as like the utopia. Does that make sense?
I'd say personally, like, I am extremely bullish on social housing. I think for a lot of reasons you've said, if nothing else, the land rent, component, it is a way to have public ownership and circulation of land rents. When you mentioned like at cost Manhattan social housing, what's kind of interesting is like the at cost implies ignoring the cost of land acquisition and land tenure. Which is like, who pulled that trick off? I'm not exactly sure. Talk about like kind of just the actual, you know, occupation of the land. I mean, that's part of the cost. And two, I think like social housing, if you are looking at generating subsidies, it can both be kind of essentially a subsidy of the land rent and or property tax exemptions, which are kind of getting the same thing. And I guess those, as far as what are actual caveats I have against social housing, I would really hate it if like social housing just continuously is subsidies for land rent and exemptions for property tax. Because if nothing else, that doesn't scale. You know, if no one is paying their land rent, like, that's just bad for municipal finance. But I think even in a lot of good programs, I think property tax exemptions are taken for granted, and that alarms me. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I'll be interested in your thoughts about this, because part of the lack of interest in quantification, or the reflexive, you know, disinterest in these kind of quantifications, makes this a hard conversation to have with a lot of public housing advocates. But the question I often have for them is, so let's say we're providing an at cost of construction apartment in Manhattan. That essentially means that you're subsidizing that tenant to the exact value of the land rent, of the location rent that they're occupying, sure. Because they're not paying it in the market price. They're getting it as the, that's the amount below market price that they're getting subsidized, quote unquote. And my question is often, why is that superior to just using market allocation, taxing the hell out of the land rents, and giving the tenant that amount of cash into their hand and letting them choose where they want to live?
I would say the responses I see across the board is, one, it's like, oh, on paper, that looks good. It will never happen, mm-hmm. which I'm actually pretty you know, fine with, of saying, like, oh, a lot of times you make a mm-hmm. nice excuse and you don't follow up on it. I think that's mm-hmm. completely real. Mm-hmm. You know, show me the yep. horse. You know, don't just tell me about it. But yep. I think, two, is like there's a weird tendency, too, which is the idea that taxes – if you tax the rich and then you give the money to everyone else, or, you know, tax resources, give, like, that doesn't actually redistribute resources. Like, there's this, like, it's a weird idea that if you tax billionaires, this actually, billionaires want that. Billionaires want you to tax the billionaires,
yeah, yeah.
because this means only the billionaires can be billionaires, because only they can afford the taxes on being billionaires. It's like, I don't like that. It's just this, like, I mean, I think that's just a weird brain worm that, like, I can't even really take seriously. But I mean, I think if you talk about money and stocks and everything, it's like, well, that's clearly stupid. But with real estate, it's like, if you tax real estate, only the rich can own real estate. People buy mm-hmm. that. And I don't know. It's, yeah. it's so silly. Yeah. I can't really say much about it. Yeah.
Yeah. I find that, an infuriating trap that people fall into as well. It's very strange. It doesn't come up at all with wealth taxes. You know, majority of wealth is real estate. And so we'd be taxing that anyway. I think it, and you see this a little bit with kind of people who would otherwise be big fans of Georgism, this kind of like, oh, but that'll just get passed on into rents. There's kind of this assumption that, you know, if anything we do to landlords in a market setting will just go straight through into an impact on tenants. And so it's like, okay, tax gets passed to the tenants. Only the rich can afford to pay the tax. So they buy all the land and it's not going to solve the problem. So yeah, look, it's just frustrating. I'll just go back to the more interesting, I think, kind of rebuttal of my...
I'm going to jump in, but I mean, on that topic, yeah. I think it's so funny that they have this Just So story that, oh, land value taxes are actually not a threat to real estate interests. They invite it. They'll pass it along. They're not scared. Look in California at the state level with like a simple LVT study last year, and just an all points alert. The landlord associations, the realtors, the mm-hmm. weird like highway mm-hmm. lobbyists, like it was an incredible effort to kill this study in its crib by the most powerful interest. And the so-called people who like feel they're against real estate interests, it's like, that doesn't tell you something? I don't know. Like, it's so weird mm-hmm. to me. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think they have, they struggle to differentiate between like landed interests and real estate interests. And so sometimes they kind of miss the spotting that kind of reflexive opposition from landed interests. I'll just say, acknowledge that your kind of political economy argument about why the focus on public housing, I think, is totally justified. Yeah, it is fair to say that, you know, this utopian system that I would implement of taxing land and paying it out as UBI and using market allocation, we're not there. And so this is why I'm, you know, entirely comfortable with incremental progress towards this goal, you know, via public housing. I don't want to kind of let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Sure.
And then I wondered if, just to kind of change tack a little bit, I'd be interested in talking about kind of the more normie oppositions to Georgism and NIMBYism, because I actually think that kind of might be a more major part of our obstacles. And then it might be useful to also sift through the areas where there are like Georgists that are anti-Yimby and Yimbys that are anti-Georgist and that kind of.
I focus on kind of the not right valence stuff because I think it's more interesting. I think the right wing stuff is a lot more boring. But yeah, let's get into that. One final thought though on social housing, which is it is very weird. We talk about subsidy, and to me, like honestly, the reason I'm bullish about social housing is actually because of the non-subsidized version, or at least not general subsidized version, which is public housing plus market rate production in your public housers means you can bend the cost curve down almost without end. But people are very, very, very upset about the idea of market rate social housing. You know, they feel it's like that's not what social housing is. In like the fight over California social housing the last couple of years has been derailed. It hasn't been what killed it, but in the discourse by people saying what we need is heavily means tested social housing. And I just completely disagree with that. I mean, maybe that's kind of getting to a very fundamental thing, but I hate means testing. I won't lie. Like that's kind of a foundational thing, but I don't know. Do you see kind of the idea of means tested kind of social housing only for the poorest changing, or do you think that is also part and parcel of this whole thing?
I don't understand the reflexive opposition to it either. I very much like the model where you have social housing that has a range of incomes in it and you use market rate rents from the medium to higher income residents to cross-subsidize affordable units for people at the low end of the income and wealth spectrum. I think it's a great model. I think it gets you kind of mixed neighborhoods. It gets you social mixing. It gets you, you know, upward mobility because you're meeting people from different classes and so on. Yeah, I don't get it. I mean, I think it's a distaste for market rents. I think it's a feeling that it's milquetoast because it doesn't come with an increase in tax revenues. It doesn't tax the rich, you know. So I think those are kind of where it comes from. But yeah, I don't understand it.
Okay, right wingers. Like one thing that's maybe I'm in a bubble. The thing for me is it's weird to me that right wingers never are open in actual politically. I mean, of course, if you go online, there's freaks of all sorts. But in real political movements, at least in any place I've seen, people don't really speak their mind. Not even really the. I mean, you get people who are like kind of just salt of the earth, anti-homeless freaks everywhere. Like that exists. But it is like. To me, I think one of the most indicative things, like Palo Alto a few years ago, Greer Stone and Pat Burt wrote, like, you know, council people wrote an article saying it's like talking about upzoning. It's like, folks, this is gentrification on steroids. Can you believe this? And like, it's like, you're Palo Alto. Like, why are you talking about gentrification? Like, it's like, but it's weird that them, you look at the former mayor of Beverly Hills, friend of the show, John Mirisch, like these people love to talk about with like a left-wing valence instead of making an honest right-wing argument. I don't know, like, the question of why does the kind of left-flavored anti-Yimbyism, anti-Georgism matter? To me, it matters because, like, the right-wingers seem to be comfortable using it more than their own arguments. Is this a bubble I'm in, or are you seeing people actually kind of actually make coherent ideological right-wing arguments?
Yeah, there are both, but that is also one of my critiques, I think is the right word, for the Georgist anti-Yims, and maybe also the kind of left-wing kind of anti-Georgists or anti-Yims, is that they create narratives that enable the kind of self-interested homeowner NIMBY or right-winger or whatever to hide their, you know, what I think are malign interests or malign values, couch them in this kind of progressive sounding language while supporting policies that it's tricky because that doesn't necessarily make the arguments from those anti-Yims and anti-Georgists wrong. It's just a kind of a frustration of the like impact they're having on the discourse. But yeah, I certainly, you know, I'm actually increasingly seeing the kind of Cameron Murray, Patrick Condon kind of style of being really picked up by people who are members of like home ownership associations and things. And you can see them, you know, you can see them saying, we don't need YIMBY, we need a land value tax. These people don't support a land value tax. They're not going to vote for it. They're not involved in any groups advocating for it. They just like it as a mechanism to oppose YIMBY.
I have talked to both, you know, Cameron, you know, Murray and Patrick Condon on this show. Honestly, I think their arguments are full of holes. You can go to the tape, listen to it. But on top of it, if nothing else, I made the argument again and again. It's very weird to be anti-YIMBY and pro-Georgist as a reason to be anti-YIMBY, because it's this weird false dichotomy of, like, if you don't do YIMBYism, you get these more radical actions, as opposed to in practice, I don't think that's true at all. I think if you don't do reforms that will change the built environment, you're just going to get stagnation and misery, you know, instead. Like, you'll get the same thing. It's very weird and magical to believe that if you resist upzoning, you'll get the perfect solution. I don't know, but I think honestly, for reasons I've said again and again, if you create more apartments, you get more renters. Renters are more likely to create land value taxes. Like, it's the idea that homeowners who are anti-upzoning are going to be your political movers. I don't know. It's just it's transparently kind of just not going to be the case, and it's very weird that, like, you continually see this happening. I mean, I guess I don't blame the self-interested homeowners for reaching for arguments. I don't blame people like Patrick Condon for reaching for an audience who listen to him. It's very flattering to have people listen to you. What I blame is for anyone else not seeing through this and giving these people more of an audience that who are smart enough to kind of see these dynamics.
Mm-hmm. I think devil's advocate for them. I think if we assume that they're well-intentioned, which I think they are, there is an argument that their audience are the kind of people that we've been describing as the tenant activist kind of wrong vibe, anti-Georgist, anti-YIMBYs, and that they can collect that group of people and build a coalition of, let's not focus on upzoning. We got to focus on land value capture and doing that land value capture through, maybe an LVT, but I think they more often focus on, you know, windfall gains taxes on upzonings,
affordable housing,
public housing, social housing, inclusionary zoning. Exactly. That's kind of the good faith defense of their like strategic choice. I think that the better strategy and the one I've been trying to carve out is that I think there's a lot more alignment between Georgists and YIMBYs, a much larger coalition that can be there that, you know, for both of them. I do think there are empirical parts of the Condon and Murray arguments that are wrong. Aside from that, I just think strategically, you know, YIMBYs are going to be much better allies than kind of people who are reflexively anti-market, and B, people who are, you know, mal-incentivized homeowners pretending to be the former.
But okay, so you were talking earlier about right-wing tendencies. Now we're talking again about kind of essentially like a left argument made by Georgists for, you know, homeowners to, you know, oppose things. Well, do you think right-wing arguments really are in the mix that matter much, or like are they interesting? To me, I think they're all pretty boring.
I agree that I think they're all pretty boring. When we're talking about kind of informed, trying to actually have a coherent theory sort of style of right-wing thought, which I would kind of Rothbardian sort of ANCAP style of defense of private property, of land, and it not being interfered with by taxes or changes in zoning, perversely. I kind of actually am not that interested in talking about that because I don't think it's that relevant. I don't think they are a major sort of component of either the discourse or the like actual underlying voter base. And I would call this right wing, I think. More the larger kind of contingent of obstacles are normies who are either A, sort of reflexively defensive of the status quo, and the status quo is always what you compare a proposal against, and B, the Jeffersonian American dreamers who, you know, see the pinnacle of human achievement as a single family home in America with a low tax bill that doesn't increase and a land use regulations scheme that doesn't change it. Those two sort of types of normie, I think they're actually the major obstacle to YIMBY policy and Georgist policy and social housing policy and pro-tenant policy and all of those things. I think those are the quote unquote, the enemy, or at least the people who need to be convinced that we offer a better vision.
Okay, I think that's really interesting for a couple of reasons, and I would say that I agree and disagree in some senses. I would say that I think the reason I would kind of classify that as both the normies being non-ideological or kind of pre-ideological and the Jeffersonian folks who, I mean, honestly, I would call that its own particular form of right-wing ideology. And I think that's a kind of a, it's a hierarchy in its own sense. It's this idea that honestly, only the good people can become homeowners. And if you have trouble with housing, you're probably a bad, lazy person. And that's pretty widespread. I talked to kind of the most coherent ideological, you know, NIMBYs. They're very comfortable saying that. I'm fine with my kids moving cross country because they couldn't hack it. It's like, okay, well, at least you're honest about it. But I guess the question about the normies who are not really ideological is, too, I guess I feel that the battles of ideology flow down. The people, they're in the pit. Some ideologies win. They win in academia. They win in think tanks. They win among the people who are real bug-eyed. And eventually that flows down to people who are more normie, which I guess is why ideological battles matter. It doesn't affect normies directly, but most people don't really do their thinking for themselves. They kind of listen to people they trust and respect, people in their communities. But it is interesting you say that kind of people, they are almost instinctively anti-change, or kind of there is at least a skepticism of change in their neighborhood. And I suppose that is, I don't know if you call that distinctly ideological, but I think that definitely is true. I think most normal people who live in a neighborhood, they don't want to see an apartment building where there isn't, because I don't know, let's play it safe. Like, I think that is a system that is coherent. It makes sense. You see it. And I suppose are we going to overcome that kind of small C conservatism through persuasion, debate, or what's your approach to all this?
Yeah. So, it's interesting. I'm not sure the extent to which this kind of status quo defender is something that has kind of emerged from the like think tank discourse milieu. There might be a little bit of it. You hear them sometimes appealing to kind of general societal values like, I don't know, meritocracy. And
well, I think they're looking for something. I think if people are status quoist and then they hear, oh, it's going to create gentrification and unaffordability, like they're just grasping for straws, I think, to the most extent.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah. And that's been my experience in, going and kind of explaining to policymakers or, you know, to public panels and things, the land value tax. Very, very often I encounter exactly what you're describing, where it's like, this person's never encountered this idea before. They are uncomfortable about the idea of changing society in a small or large way. And they are very liable to just latching onto a specific objection and treating it as fatal and kind of not going any further. You get, in the case of the YIMBY, it's, this is a leafy suburb. I bought into this, looking for it to be a neighborhood, and now there's going to be an apartment here. That's, that's spooky and different. Or, they kind of treat the zoning as like a property right that they've bought and that you're now sort of taking away from them or forcing change upon them. And then with the land value tax, they are often pretty amenable to kind of some of the Georgist arguments, that taxing land is better than taxing buildings and income. It's more fair to tax, speculation than people who go out and work, those kinds of things. But they will latch onto an obstacle and they'll cling to it for dear life. And it'll be stuff like, valuation's too hard. The transition will be disruptive to the economy. The old widow, she's just retired and all her wealth is in the house. So now you're trying to tax it. And sometimes, really crazy things, like in Colorado recently, one of the objections was, if a land value tax gets, all this housing built downtown, where will people park their cars? And this came up a couple of times. And it's like, you've just invented that and now it's your lifeline. I think this, used to be someone who thought that, politics happens by debate about ideas and the best ones win. That still is part of my worldview, but I think this kind of, let's stick with the status quo because it's working pretty well, is a very, very common and is a big obstacle to all of the things we've been talking about.
Yeah, I don't think battles for ideology win per se, but I think there is a march through institutions, as it were, and I think that you do see, you know, kind of academia, think tanks, or so on. It's like, who can you point to? And I think if there is a general consensus of, you know, all these reforms, those are the reforms that people tend to go to. But yeah, I think people who are, there's a class, you know, nature to this too. People who are fine with the status quo are people who are not suffering. They're going to be, you know, people in, you know, a pretty nice seat. So it's like, it not too surprising that they wouldn't want to see that change very much, you know, across the board. And I guess, you know, that kind of speaks, you mentioned earlier about people working on these issues, testing them in the labs of empirics and so on, that you respect. You mentioned Tony Damiano and Yona Freemark, and I guess it's one thing I worry about is my evaluation of someone like Tony Damiano is, I would say, kind of like a god of the gaps of kind of anti-YIMBYism or something. It seems like a lot of people are very seemingly happy to find weird nits to pick in the idea that more housing can help, and they'll find a result. They publish a result, which is usually a fairly limited kind of impact. And then a lot of people are like extremely motivated to pick it up and say, oh yeah, you know, YIMBYism disproved, read this paper. And I don't know if, like, I don't want to maybe point fingers at the authors of these academic articles saying it, but it when you have an audience that are seemingly slavering to hear this one conclusion, it's perhaps not too surprising they find nits to pick.
I mean, that audience capture mechanism is ever present, and it's something that YIMBYs can fall prey to as well, or researchers doing YIMBY work. I don't know. I mean, I guess it has to be evaluated on an individual researcher's basis. You know, Damiano and Frenier, I think, have only done that one sort of empirical paper that really gets waved around. So I, you know, don't think they've kind of got sucked into doing more in that space. Maybe they're a little bit kind of, they have a social connection to the kind of YIMBY skepticism now, but I don't think it's been too bad. Freemark, I think, has been, pursued several papers in several different directions that kind of can have both pro-YIMBY and anti-YIMBY interpretations. Yeah, I'm not sure. My problem with some of this stuff is that once you're in the space of questioning someone's intentions and honesty in their research, it's kind of all over, because, you know, the same thing gets thrown at YIMBYs all the time, and now nobody trusts anybody's empirics, and we have no way of actually deciding what's good and bad. So I try to kind of stay away from it, and I want to look at the paper and see what it found, and compare it to the rest of the research. Does that make sense?
That's definitely a fair and safe approach. I can point fingers at people and say, oh, I think you're cozy, you know, with the with the kind of anti-YIMBYs. And this is mostly goes to like urban geography departments more than people who would do anything related to like economics. I mean, this is kind of a sideline. I would love to actually pick the brain of someone like, you know, Spiro Ferrer of, you know, UCLA, because like he seems to talk a big game, but like, are they actually curious? I don't know. I would love to actually hear what people have to say in a way that doesn't seem so kind of snipey and kind of oblique. But what I'm saying is, a lot of these ideas, there is perhaps unfairly, I'm talking less about individuals as much as institutions, have antibodies against anything that kind of seems, we don't do that here. And I think LVT, more than anything, perhaps has those issues. You know, it has a reputation as being the domain of cranks. And I think in the last couple decades, being moved into actually a place of real respect among academics, I think is interesting. And I think it's shown a bunch of friction and inertia it's had to overcome. And I guess that's the march through institutions I guess I'm speaking of.
Yeah, I'll just say that, well, my concern with it is that it's sort of starting down the same path that YIMBY went down, maybe, which is that, you know, where we are increasingly seeing, you know, genuine, you know, economic research that's grappling with some of the questions around LVT, starting a revival, I guess. And I, you know, in my work, I'm interested in supporting that. So, you know, get in touch. My concern is that that's going to kind of become, okay, again, it's, you know, this is a technocratic solution that's being pushed by the neoliberal to sort of SOCDEM think tanks. It doesn't fundamentally challenge the, you know, the status quo of capitalism and markets. And so we'll get those kind of same, you know, leftist narratives against it that then get co-opted by people on the right. And, you know, it becomes this horrible battle that YIMBY has been in the States. I'm just kind of scared of that happening to land tax as well. It's my enduring frustration that, you know, we Georgists and YIMBs can't just work with people in the kind of, you know, left tenant advocacy space in the areas of agreement against the kind of homeowner NIMBY, who I think are the kind of actual core, you know, obstacle to, you know, any kind of increment or revolutionary progress in this space. Yeah. And that's kind of why I sort of share your frustration that we haven't managed to kind of like get into the real nailed down specifics of where our disagreements lie with people like Alexander Ferrer that you were describing.
Sure. Now, I guess like one thing that's kind of, I mean, you talk about normies. Actually, I feel like, honestly, the discourse among like YIMBYs, I think, has become much better insofar as, I guess probably the median person who's heard about it has heard about it not back in like 2014, but probably in the last couple years. And they probably think about it as like kind of do-gooder reformists in their local neighborhood advocacy organizations. I mean, I think it has kind of like a well-meaning lib wine mom kind of flavor to it, which I think is a good thing. And I honestly, I think that the weird discourse is very, very under the shadows. I don't think it actually reflects the real world normies very much. Maybe I have the wrong perspective, but that's the kind of perspective I'm seeing. Would Georgism have that same kind of tendency? I'd say it has a challenge insofar as do-gooder homeowners are more likely to be YIMBYs than to want to increase their own taxes. It's possible, but I don't know. I do think that, I mean, I'm kind of curious, like, do you see a march through the normies?
I don't know. I think part of it is about policy design and coming up with sort of forms of shift to land value tax that, you know, benefit the median voter, including the median home voter, which I think you can sometimes do. But part of the other side of this is actually that, and it's true for YIMBYs and as it is for Georgists, people in my kind of, you know, economist technocrat kind of space have a tendency to focus on, you know, the efficiency arguments and the impact on housing construction and, you know, what the coefficients look like and those kinds of things. I sometimes see pushback from YIMBYs who are kind of think land tax is okay, but they're not kind of passionate about Georgism, along the lines of like, why are you focusing on these more, you know, values and narrative based kind of arguments around fairness and equity and inclusion and, you know, sharing the earth and like all those kinds of arguments that sound squishy to an economist, but those are actually the things that, you know, people in the normie, like, you know, world engage with. And so I think we Georgists and YIMBYs have to have a vision that we sell that appeals to those kinds of values. And it's about, you know, sharing the earth, making sure that everybody can pursue opportunity. It has to be very pro-urban for both of them, that, you know, we love cities, we love the, you know, quality of life that cities can provide, including ones that are dense and walkable and have public transport and, you know, beautiful parks and thriving job markets and so on. I think, yeah, at the end of the day, you can do all the technocratic stuff that you like, and you should, have the evidence base to go with your claims. But we should also be comfortable with like selling the vision of YIMBY and of Georgism on those grounds.
Yeah, I think I definitely agree. And I think that's perhaps a reason I'm maybe more bearish of Georgism as far as the narrative to the normies or the march mm-hmm. to the normies, insofar as I think it's fairly easy to make a narrative that is YIMBY. It's a story of an apartment that gets built and then kind of a nice little photogenic family that lives there. But like, I don't know, like the idea of land rents being redistributed, I think it applies to system thinkers, it applies to people who are kind of like bug-eyed and think in this like weirdly abstracted space. I feel like it's mm-hmm. extremely hard to make narratives that normies like, like are kind of appealing out of it. And I've definitely been mulling it over for years and years and years, but I just think it is inherently kind of counterintuitive and tricky. And if it's a battle in kind of vibes between that and Jeffersonianism, I think Jeffersonianism really it is the reigning champion.
Yeah, that's right.
It's defeatism, but
I don't think it's a done deal. I mean, I do think it's a tough battle. But I at least like that we have this positive vision to offer. I also think it's good to have that kind of, you know, pro cities and pro opportunity and pro movement and, you know, dynamism and growth and these kinds of things. I think that that is more appealing to the normie than, you know, focusing too much on the negative side of, you know, unfairness and inequality and the rich and they're taking our, you know, fair resources and we, you know, we are going to overthrow the system and, you know, everything like that. I think it's good that we don't fall into that trap too much in terms of trying to capture the normies at least. And that's kind of been the idea behind the resource justice kind of framing of you know my section at the Robert Schalkenberg Foundation, which is that, you know, we're looking to do research that, you know, fosters a socioeconomic system where everybody had their fair share of the value of natural resources, and we use those resources efficiently, but we use them equitably and sustainably as well. Which I hope is an appealing vision.
Is it right or wrong to say that the dominant narrative right now among normies is negative, which is the idea that everything is fine, developers come in, it's bad? Because that is a very appealing narrative.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have my finger on the pulse of how that kind of feels at the sort of ground neighborhood level inside a city that's changing. I think you're probably right that there's this reflex of like change is bad kind of a vibe. Yeah. But I think it can be pushed back against with the like positive vision of the city. And
sure.
Actually, Melbourne YIMBY put out a sort of a vision document early last year, and actually California YIMBY have one that's similar. And I think that kind of stuff is great, and Georgia should do it more as well.
That sounds, very good. But actually, okay, so one kind of like final thing I think we need to wrap up. Talking about, I feel like ideology, like a lot, I mean, I think that it's probably a good thing you say, like, let's not undermine people's intentions. But like, honestly, I will be honest, I think a lot of people who are anti-YIMB and Georgist, I think at the very least, the fact they don't argue about it makes me skeptical of them. It's like, I want to see people defend their ideology. The one folks who are very open about defending their ideology, I'd say are the quote unquote lead paint caucus. You know, it's the folks that are, I would say, anti-city, anti-land value. It's about driving land values to nothing. It is about cities should be full of like vermin and crime because that means it's affordable. It is pro-scuzziness. It's like pro-primitivism. It's anti-immigration. It's anti-movement. It's just like, it's the idea that like, but I mean, I think I'm pointing towards the different aspects of it, but like, I don't think these people matter because I think to most people, they just seem like weird freaks, but I do respect the fact that at least they have an ideology.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm trying to think about how respect them. Maybe. I mean, I think to diagnose them, I think I call this kind of rent nihilism, which is that, you know, land rents in a market setting are always going to adjust to, you know, capture the total benefit of that location compared to somewhere else. So if it's nice and lovely and clean and has parks and transit, it's going to be expensive. And their reaction to that is, okay, let's make things worse because then it'll be cheaper. That's my kind of diagnosis. I kind of hope that Georgism is the antidote to that because we offer, you know, this idea that you can have nice things, then you can capture the value of them and share them with everybody. So everybody benefits from the nice things.
Well, the Georgist thing is progress is accompanied by poverty unless you fix it. And like, okay, well, I have the solution. Let's avoid progress. It's like, okay, like hard to argue with it, you know, like that is an answer. It's kind of depressing.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I mean the places in the US with the least homelessness are the, you know, the places that are very low income and falling apart. So you can kind of see how they get there, but I think we have a better approach.
That's funny. I mean, I guess that goes like what like the idea of like brain drain. You know, like we started this conversation like migration is good. People point to migration as bad because it's going to like drain all the folks away from one place to another, and I think the answer to pro-migration people is kind of like, I don't care that much, but the idea that we should stick people in miserable places because so they'll at least they won't leave it, you know, they won't abandon it. I don't know, like it's something.
Yeah, that's a sort of another strand of the anti-Yim, anti-Georgia stuff is, well, instead of making nice places and capturing the land value, well, sorry, instead of capturing the land value in places that are already nice, why don't we just push the land value somewhere else? Why don't we make attractive places, you know, outside of San Francisco, outside of New York? We can, you know, revive the Rust Belt cities and, you know, people will move there and that'll solve the affordability problem. Yeah, which I don't know that you can do that without spending a huge amount of public resources in the process. You know, I think it's a lot easier to do the reverse, to enable people to move to places that have, you know, tons of opportunity and that are thriving, and then just to make sure that the benefits of that are shared with everybody. I think that's,
yeah,
well, easier to do, and cheaper to do, and, you know, better off in the end as well, because, you know, the benefits of super cities and urban agglomeration and all those kinds of things are pretty well documented. I don't see why we should fight against that, you know, force of nature, so to say.
Yeah, I think there's an argument like, oh, maybe we shouldn't have two mega cities. Maybe we could have like 150 decent sized cities or 50 or whatever.
Yeah.
I think honestly 100 or so good sized cities in a place like America is probably about right. But like there are a ton of small towns that I think, like, if you are the 75th biggest city in Nebraska, I don't think you have a great future. I don't know.
Yeah, my focus with those things is I'm much more interested in helping people than helping places.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's completely valid to want to, you know, direct resources to the people who are in those places, who you know, maybe can't move or, you know, are so old or whatever that they're kind of tied to the place. Help them, make sure there's healthcare and, you know, opportunities and education if they want to get the skills so they can move to the city and so on. But kind of to try and help the place by moving people from, you know, better places to those places that are not so good. I just think it's, you know, it's a huge amount of sort of state involvement and like deciding what spatial outcomes should look like when, you know, we have a perfectly good way of doing it. That's where cities came from in the first place.
Yeah. And I think even with internal passports, even with state resources, it's still tough. But before we wrap up, any final thoughts, any final, you know, words of wisdom before we close up?
No, I mean, I think that sort of covers the broad thrust of it. I mean, I guess my main sort of appeal or argument here is that, you know, I think Georgia Synergies, we have, you know, a huge amount of shared values, shared outcomes that we're looking for. I think that we are, you know, building a really nice coalition, and I, you know, encourage people to continue down that path, both within Georgism and within Yimbyism. I kind of hope that we haven't, you know, talk the left wing too much, because I still continue to believe that we have shared goals with those people and shared values and a shared enemy in terms of the anti everything homeowner. And I would just, you know, beg those people to engage with us in good faith and to realize that we do actually genuinely like want to see a more equitable and efficient world that's better for people at the bottom end. And that, you know, I'm always available to talk about areas where they disagree with the arguments we've laid out and to try and sort of nail down where the precise like differences of opinion are about facts of the world so that we can, you know, move forward together. That would be my general thrust.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. I'll just tell the audience, you know, my Twitter handle is at GeorgistSteve, I work for the Robert Schockenbach Foundation, which can be found at schockenbach.org. It's schockenbach.org. And thanks very much for having me.
Cool. We have been talking to Stephen Hoskins all about the many flavors of anti-Yimbyism, anti-Georgism, and much more. I probably should disclose that unrelated to this, but I also volunteer on the board of the Robert Schockenbach Foundation. You can find this episode and all previous episodes of this radio program at the website seethecat.org. This is a presentation of KCSU, Stanford.